You probably have a task sitting on your desk right now, one that could entirely change the trajectory of your week, maybe even your career. You know exactly what it is. And yet, you just spent like 45 minutes organizing your spam folder just to avoid doing it.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's the ultimate trap of human nature. You will reorganize your desktop icons. You'll suddenly decide the kitchen needs deep cleaning. Literally anything to avoid that one specific heavy piece of work. It just sits on your chest like a cinder block.
Yeah, exactly. Well, welcome to this deep dive. Because if that feeling of avoidance sounds familiar to you, you are definitely in the right place. Today, we are fundamentally rewiring how you approach that exact resistance.
Right, getting to the root of it.
Yeah. I'm a productivity systems coach, and I spend my days helping professionals try to turn that procrastination into, well, repeatable, friction-free operating systems. And I will be the first to admit, traditional willpower advice simply does not work for most people.
No, it really doesn't. And as a former B2B sales manager, I've spent years in the trenches managing teams, building sales funnels from scratch, and just tackling the absolute most uncomfortable work you can imagine before ever getting to the enjoyable stuff.
Which is brutal.
It is. And I can promise you, from a pure business perspective, avoiding the hard work doesn't make it disappear. It just makes it exponentially more expensive.
That is exactly why we're pulling our insights today from this really brilliant chapter. It's called Do What You Hate First and Do It Like You Love It. And it's from the book Laws of Life, Book Two. Now Build the System for Your Life by Jack Spurko.
A great book, yeah.
So our mission for this deep dive is to explore the core law of this chapter, which is that discipline is not about generating fake motivation. It's actually about correct sequencing, radical honesty, and building a system around actual human nature instead of, pretending that avoidance doesn't exist.
Right, and we have to start by looking at what actually happens when we avoid things, because the tasks people avoid are rarely the meaningless ones. In fact, they are almost always the most critical actions required to move your life forward, to increase your income or just prevent a massive disaster.
Yeah, the stakes are high.
Exactly. But when we dodge them, the results are incredibly predictable. I mean, avoided tasks get deferred indefinitely, they get rushed at the very end, done poorly, or they simply never get accomplished at all.
And as a coach, this is exactly where I see clients completely burn out. They think, I just need to be tougher. I need like more discipline. They basically treat discipline like a battery they just have to charge up with caffeine and motivational videos.
Which never lasts.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
But Jack Spurko mentions this incredible t-shirt created by his friend John Willis of SOE Tactical Gear. The shirt just says, discipline is doing what you hate, like you love it.
It's a fantastic slogan. I mean, it hits right at the emotional core of what discipline actually requires. But as Jack points out, a t-shirt has to be brief. What it leaves out is an actual system.
Right.
A slogan might give you a momentary burst of energy to crush a task today, but it doesn't give you a framework for organizing your daily life tomorrow or the next day based on accepting how humans actually operate.
Right. And that is the missing piece. I mean, you don't have to miraculously change your personality to genuinely love staring at spreadsheets or doing cold outreach. Discipline is actually just correct sequencing.
Yes.
The unenjoyable work must physically be sequenced before the enjoyable work. Like, isn't that really what it boils down to?
Exactly. Unless the literal workflow of a project requires a different order, the less enjoyable work always comes first. You do not need a motivational breakthrough, you just need to alter your sequence.
Yeah.
And to really understand what that looks like in a high-stakes, ruthless environment, well, Jack's story from his 1998 B2B sales job is just the perfect blueprint.
Okay, yes. I want to dig deep into this story because it perfectly bridges the gap between knowing you should do something and actually building a physical system to force yourself to do it. So take us back to 1998.
Okay, so in 1998, Jack gets a job at a company called Data Connection. They sell voice and data cabling to businesses. Now, Jack loved the creative side of the job. He loved doing the client bids, designing the systems, negotiating the final deals.
All the fun stuff.
Right, the fun stuff. But the reality of B2B sales, especially back then, before you could just run internet ads, is entirely top of funnel math. If you want to close 10 sales and your closing rate is 50%, you need 20 bids.
Simple math.
Exactly.
Why?
The only thing you truly control is how many bids you put into the top of the funnel.
And the only way to fill that funnel in 1998 was cold calling.
Which is brutal, soul-crushing work. I mean, it means getting past defensive gatekeepers without insulting them. It means being told to kick rocks 10 to 20 times just to get one tiny toe hold. And out of those toe holds, you lose 9 out of 10. Jack hated it. So naturally, he did what everyone does. He pushed it to the end of his day. He would design a bid. He would try to move up a lunch meeting. He'd do literally anything to avoid picking up that phone. Cold calling became the thing he only did when he had absolutely zero other options.
It means his funnel started drying up.
Yeah.
But then he has this wild epiphany at the gym, right? Like he's working out and he hits what runners call the wall.
Yeah, exactly.
That moment where everything hurts and you just want to quit.
Yeah.
But when you push through that wall, your body releases endorphins. The pain actually starts to feel good. You get into this hyper-focused zone. And he realizes he needs to bring that exact physical, aggressive workout mindset right into his corporate office.
And the way he implements this is so brilliantly raw. He goes out and buys a cheap vertical door mirror and hangs it right on the back of his office door.
Okay.
Every single morning from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m., he strips off his corporate dress shirt. He puts on a regular t-shirt and a pair of literal physical weightlifting gloves.
Wait, really? Weightlifting gloves in the office?
Yes. He stands in front of that mirror, looks at his prospect list, and he attacks the telephone like he's stepping into a boxing ring. He only sits down when he has to take notes on a lead. For 2 solid hours, he uses physical cues to force himself into that endorphin-fueled workout state.
I love thinking about how absurd that must have looked, but it completely stripped away his office worker identity and replaced it with a fighter identity.
Completely.
And the results really speak for themselves, because before this, his previous job paid $14 an hour. What happened after he put on the gloves?
The growth was exponential.
Yeah.
He tracked this from April to the end of the year, so just 9 months. In those 9 months, spending only 2 hours a morning with his bizarre mirror and glove system, Jack wrote $2.7 million in business.
That is insane.
Right. To put that in perspective, the entire company had only done $3.5 million the entire previous year. He outsold the other 3 salespeople combined.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me. I like to think of this strategy like riding a bicycle up a brutal steep hill. The climb is the suck part. Your thighs are burning. You're out of breath. It requires 100% of your energy, and you hate every single second of it.
Oh, yeah, the worst.
But once you crest that hill, you fly down the other side. You coast almost effortlessly for the rest of the day. By doing the brutal cold calls first, he crested the hill by 10 a.m.
And what he was really doing was removing the psychological drag. Because when you put a hated task off until 4 p.m., it doesn't just sit quietly on your desk. It actively drains your mental energy all day long.
Oh, absolutely.
It's like a computer with a massive program running in the background. Everything else you do just runs slower. When you knock it out first, you experience this massive wave of relief, and that relief instantly translates into momentum. Clarity always follows action.
Okay, I am entirely sold on the psychology here. But as a coach, if I tell my clients to just put on listening gloves and yell in a mirror, they're going to look at me like I'm crazy.
Fair point.
That is a great psychological trick to break a rut. But how do we move from raw hustle to a sustainable daily operating system? Like, what if my client has 50 different things pulling at them?
That brings us directly to the priority framework. Willpower and psychological hacks are great starters, but they're unreliable long term. Systems do not care how you feel. So Jack lays out this ironclad self-adjusting triage system based on 3 distinct priority levels.
Okay, let's put this to the test. Say I have an entrepreneur client. They sit down at a messy desk. They have corporate taxes due tomorrow. They really want to redesign their website logo because it's fun. They need to call a furious supplier who got the wrong shipment. And they have a client proposal to finish by Friday. How does this system triage all that chaos?
Perfect example. So we run it straight through the 3 levels. Priority 1 involves 3 very specific conditions. First, if you do not do it, something really bad happens. Second, you actively hate doing it or feel intense resistance toward it. Third, it is a prerequisite that must be finished before a priority 2 task can even start. In your scenario, the corporate tax is due tomorrow and calling the furious supplier are priority 1. They have immediate bad consequences if ignored, and calling angry people is universally hated.
Wait, I get why taxes are priority 1, but why is a hated task automatically given the same weight as disaster prevention?
Because in Jack's system, an avoided hated task is a pending disaster. Avoidance accumulates interest. If you leave that furious supplier until Friday, you might lose the account entirely.
Wow. Yeah, that makes total sense. Okay, so what is priority two then?
Priority two tasks are those that absolutely must be done by the end of the current cycle, whether you define your cycle as today, this week, or this month. They might also be tasks that complete an ongoing project, or they enable a priority three task.
Got it.
So finishing the client proposal by Friday is your priority two. It has to be done by the end of the cycle.
Which obviously leaves priority three.
Exactly. Priority three is the wanted or nice to have items. They might be necessary eventually, but they can easily wait until the next cycle. Redesigning the logo, that is pure priority three. It's fun, it feels like work, but it isn't moving the needle today.
What I love about this is how fluid it is.
Yeah.
Jack compares this to an emergency room triage, right?
Yes, the ER analogy is brilliant. A hospital doesn't check a rigid SOP when a bleeding patient arrives. They adapt instantly to the physical reality in front of them. If a patient comes in with a sprained ankle, they wait. If someone comes in with chest pain, they get bumped up.
Right.
But if the paramedics wheel in someone who has been in a severe car crash and is actively bleeding out, the entire system shifts. Everyone else waits. The doctors don't consult a manual. Priority is dictated by the bleeding.
And there's a fantastic real-world example of this in the book regarding Jack's farm. On a normal Tuesday, his priority one tasks are all about his business, prepping his podcast, writing show notes, doing the artwork. Those are his non-negotiables. But if he wakes up at 6 a.m. and a water line to the livestock is ruptured overnight, suddenly that broken pipe is the bleeding patient in the ER.
Exactly. The podcast prep immediately gets shoved down to priority two. The farm emergency becomes a 1A priority. He has to go out, fix the pipe temporarily so the animals survive, and then the permanent plumbing fix becomes a new priority two task for later in the week. The system completely absorbs the chaos without breaking.
But what happens when new, massive variables enter your life by choice? Because fixing a pipe is a reaction. But say you decide to write a book or you want to build a course, how does this triage system handle a massive self-imposed variable without the person completely burning out?
The rule for variables here is strict but incredibly effective. First, if you can eliminate them, crush them. If a variable doesn't serve your ultimate goals, get rid of it. Do not take it on. But if you can't eliminate it, like if writing that wealth-building book serves your long-term vision, then you must manage and mitigate it. You integrate the book into the priority system, take on only one or two major variables at a time, work them aggressively until they're finished, and then, and this is key, you take a planned break to recharge before returning to your normal baseline.
Which requires a terrifying amount of self-awareness. And that actually leads directly to what Jack calls the crucial bonus law. You must never lie to yourself about priority. Lying to yourself is the absolute most destructive form of lying.
It is the destroyer of dreams, truly.
Yeah, if you pretend that redesigning your logo, which is a priority three task, is actually priority one just because it's creative and fun, you are entirely sabotaging your own progress.
Priority must be dictated by order and consequence, not by your intention or your mood. If a task truly matters and you avoid it, that avoidance is quietly deciding your future for you.
Okay, so accurately prioritizing the work you hate is really powerful. It forces you to do it. But what if you just want to get rid of the hated tasks forever? I mean, prioritizing a cold call still means I have to make the cold call. Is there a way to evolve the system so the hated task simply vanishes from my plate?
Yes. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this is where we transition from merely grinding hard to intelligently designing your life. It's encapsulated in a framework Jack calls the HATE formula.
Okay, let's break down HATE. It starts with H, which stands for highlight the avoidance. I love this because it treats avoidance as just neutral data. If you feel friction, if you start rationalizing why you can just send an email tomorrow instead of making the hard phone call today, that task immediately belongs to the absolute front of the line.
Then comes A, act before comfort. You execute that highlighted task before checking your text messages. You do it before organizing your inbox. Comfort and easy work are a reward for finishing the hard task. They are not your starting point.
Which brings us to T, turn it into a system. This is where you actually repeat the hated task yourself enough times to fully understand its mechanics. You don't just blindly pass it off. You figure out the pain points. And once you understand it completely, you look for ways to design it out, automate it, or delegate it.
And finally, E, eliminate the bottleneck. When you remove that single constraint that was slowing you down, usually by finally finishing or delegating that hated task, your natural momentum returns instantly.
I really want to apply this HATE formula back to that 1998 sales job, because the math behind it completely changed my perspective on outsourcing. I mean, Jack was making those cold calls himself. He put on the gloves, he did the work, he acted before comfort, he understood the system completely.
Right, he got himself off zero, he figured out the perfect opening script, he learned the common objections, and he built a filter to know exactly when to hang up and move on. He essentially created a standard operating procedure. And the beauty of this is, once you have an SOP, you do not have to keep doing the hated task yourself. You can hire an assistant to run your system.
Walk me through the actual math on that, because for a lot of people, paying someone else to do their job feels like losing money.
Let's look at the numbers. Back then, a typical cabling contract was between $40,000 and $120,000. Let's take the very low end, $40,000. Jack's commission was 3.5%. That means he pockets $1,400 on that single sale.
Okay, $1,400.
Now, what if he hired a remote assistant and paid them $20 for every qualified lead they generated, plus a $100 bonus if the lead actually converted? If it takes that assistant $20 to find the lead and $100 on the close, it costs Jack exactly $120 to make $1,400.
And more importantly, he gets his 2 hours of morning time back. He can spend that time doing what he actually loves, which is the high-value work. Negotiations, custom design, taking existing clients to lunch. He pays a tiny, microscopic fraction of his commission to completely eliminate the task he hates.
Exactly. Yet when most people hear this, their immediate reaction is, "But that will cost me money. I'm losing $120. Jack notes that this is the ultimate employee mindset. To counter it, he borrows an acronym from the Bitcoin community, HFSP. Have fun staying poor.
Ouch. Have fun staying poor. That is a brutal acronym, but I guess it perfectly captures that trap.
Yeah.
If you refuse to spend $120 to make $1,400 while winning back 2 hours of your life, you're actively choosing to limit your own growth. You're clutching your pennies while losing your hours.
It is entirely self-imposed limitation.
But let me push back on this a little. When do we not delegate? Because surely you can't just outsource every single thing you dislike doing. Jack gives two specific examples of his own work where he refuses to delegate his current podcast workflow and a presentation he used to do at Fluke Networks.
Yeah.
Why does Jack still write his own show notes and tweak his own presentation slides? Why hasn't he outsourced that to an assistant?
Because those specific tasks require his unique, authentic voice. His podcasts are not generic, formulaic content. They are educational presentations that rely entirely on his personality and his specific worldview. You can only automate or delegate work that can be safely reduced to a repeatable formula.
The Fluke Networks example really drives this home. When he was a regional VP of sales there, the marketing department would send him these highly polished, beautiful PowerPoint decks for new products. Most VPs would just stand up and read the slides.
Right, exactly.
But Jack wouldn't. He would review the deck front to back, hide certain slides, alter the flow, and inject his own stories to make the presentation uniquely his own. He even trained his sales team to do the exact same thing.
Because authenticity cannot be outsourced. That is the dividing line. You delegate the mechanical friction, but you keep the creative essence. If it requires your soul, your voice, or your distinct expertise, you must own it.
For anyone listening who might feel a bit overwhelmed right now by the idea of building a massive spreadsheet of 1A, 2B, and 3C priorities, there is a beautifully stripped-down version of this system created by Nicole Soss, which Jack includes in the chapter. It's called My Three Things.
It distills this entire complex philosophy into one actionable sentence. Every single day, set a goal for three things that absolutely must get done, and then do those three things before you touch anything else.
It is so incredibly simple. And ironically, it forces you right back to the core law of the chapter. Because if you are being radically honest with yourself about the three things that must get done today, they're almost always the exact things you do not want to do.
So what does this all mean? It brings us to the distilled insights you can walk away with today. First, your priority must be dictated by order, not by intention. Willpower will fail you, but systems will catch you. Second, the tasks you actively avoid do not disappear. They accumulate interest, they cause background stress, and they cost you more energy the longer you wait. But most importantly, when you handle uncomfortable work first, you completely remove the psychological drag from the rest of your day. You take leverage back over your own life.
So if you are ready to stop relying on fake motivation and want to dive deeper into building these frameworks, taking control of your daily systems, and exploring the rest of Jack's concepts, you can find a wealth of resources right now at jackslaws.com.
And as we wrap up, I want to leave you with a final thought to really mull over. Look at your schedule for tomorrow. What is the one task you are avoiding right now that is quietly deciding your priorities without your consent?
That is the question that changes everything. Because until you identify it and highlight that avoidance, that task owns you. Again, you can explore more of this systematic approach to life and business at jackslaws.com.
And to close out this deep dive exactly as the chapter concludes, we are going to read the three final mental code rewrite lines verbatim. These are the directives the book asks you to consciously program into your mental computer.
Computer, identify the tasks that I don't want to do, the ones holding back my progress, and move them to the front of the line on a daily basis.
Computer, remind me that the things I do not want to do are critical to my success and help me embrace them as meaningful actions in my life.
Computer, how can I automate, design out, or hire out tasks I don't want to do so I can minimize them in my life? Remember that heavy cinder block task sitting on your desk. It is time to sequence it first, put on the gloves, and get it done. We'll see you next time.